Ladies and gentlemen, boys and girls, if there are any, welcome to this talk. I'll just say a couple of words introducing Kamala Sheela and then hand over to him. But I'll just tell you one reflection I've been having this morning, because it just seems very relevant. When I joined Butterfield, I kind of thought I was going into the simple life, you know, close to the land, wood and water and stuff like that. And I kind of realised after a while, some difficult experiences, it was not really the simple life at all. It was the elemental life. Life was not simple. Life was elemental. There was wind, rain, earth, fire, space. And simplicity was just to stay in your flat and watch TV. If you want a cup of tea, you flick the switch, and you want to do something else, you push the button. That's really simple. So I hope you're enjoying the elemental life. Whether or not that's part of Kamala Sheela's talk, I don't know. It's called Tuning In to the Buddha Field. And before I hand over, I just want to say three things about Kamala Sheela. Because he's been a Buddhist and a practitioner for many, many years. So I just thought I'd mention three kind of things he's done over his many years' practice. So one was helping start our main meditation centre, Vajraloka, in the Welsh Hills, 30 years ago, opened as a meditation centre. It's celebrating its 30th anniversary this year, I believe. But when Kamala Sheela moved there, it was just a ruined Welsh farmhouse. With nothing, you know, no the walls, I guess, but not much else. And they chose to move there, I'm not sure why, in the middle of winter, together with thick snow on the ground, to get going. There was no water supply. Yeah. I heard stories of having to dig a trench right down the hill, across the bridge, and up the valley the other side, to pipe in their water. So anyway, he did that, fully elemental, lived there for many, many years as chairman of Vajraloka, kind of getting it going, as well as the building work. And there it is today. It's a great meditation centre. Second thing was, some years later, feeling some kind of impulse, some kind of inner impulse, to go on a long, solitary retreat. So it took him some time to set that up, to kind of get out of all the things he was into. But he eventually did that and went to Teepee Valley, in Wales. Just put up a bender in a remote corner of Teepee Valley, which is in a remote part of the world, and did an 18-month solitary retreat. And I think he loved it so much, he just stayed on and on and on afterwards, and ended up living there either four years. So quite a strong experience, I think, for Kamala Sheela. And I didn't know him well before, but I think he just came out of that different. Something happened for Kamala Sheela. He was just sort of in touch with some different perspective. I remember one thing he was saying when he came out is, the elements are our friends.
Oh, yeah.
The elements are our friends. Yeah. So in Wales, I mean, what do you get? Wind, water, etc., etc. But the elements are our friends. That was the next thing. And then the third thing is kind of still in process, and maybe this will be part of his talk. After that long retreat, he had strong impulse to form community, to come together in community. So from solitary to community. And I think he's been on a quest for community ever since. It led him to join Butterfield, which is a great big kind of network and community. It led him to Ekodharma up in the Spanish mountains. It's a new retreat centre we started. And now, it's by some mysterious chain of cause and effect, it's led him down the mountain to go and live in London. But something to do with community there. An eco-community, you know, close to the elements community. So his talk is called Tuning In to the Buddha Field. I have no idea what he's going to say. I hope he does. I'd just like to hand over to Kamala Sheela. I'll ask you to welcome Kamala Sheela, Tuning In to the Buddha Field.
Thank you.
Well, I don't know what to say after that. And I just hope my glasses don't slip off my nose and I can read my notes that have been written in the last couple of days in very elemental circumstances in pencil. But I'd like to start by making clear that what I've got to say about the Buddhas and their field of influence, their fields, their Buddha fields, it isn't all from my own personal experience. Or rather, it is all from my personal experience, but it's the way, it's more like how I interpret my experience. It's more like how I interpret my experience in my own particular ways. You know, I read it. I assume we all do this, actually. I read my experience in all kinds of ways. I read the signs, if you like, that come to me. You know, just as, for example, in modern life, we've become accustomed to a very defined account of the world around us. It's based on a fantasy that we exist as concrete, unchanging individuals whose world is simply what it seems to be. Something that can be measured in terms of time and space. But Buddhism takes a very different perspective on all that. The Buddhist vision of reality is that basically everything is alive. It's a little bit like Abandu was saying, you know, the elements are our friends. I've forgotten that one. Everything is alive. And that each individual can awaken to this, you know, the nature of reality. So when we hear this little phrase, the nature of reality, it has a very particular meaning. Because when we start to think about the nature of something, we start getting into the territory I'm going to try and get into in this talk. This word, you know, using this word nature in the sense of the characteristic quality of things. And I think this is the best and most meaningful use of the word nature. You know, the word nature can very easily slip into being used in a highly conceptual, abstract, and also romantic way. So I can say I like nature. I can say that. Or I can say I like being in nature. And you know what I mean by that. I like being in the woods. You know, I like being in streams. I like streams, I like landscapes. I like skyscapes. I can even like rain. But woods and streams are just a part of nature. In that sense. You know, because nature's everywhere. Something like Abanda was also pointing to in his introduction. Nature's everywhere. It's in the city, just as much. You know, the sun and the moon still come and go. The seasons come and go. Day still follows night in the city. Stream and landscape even are still there in the city. They might be buried under quite a lot of concrete and all that, but it's there. It's there. Nature is there, as powerful as ever. So nature, in this sense of the word, is everywhere. It's also our body. It's our body, and it's also our mind. In the Buddhist terms, it's dhamma-niyamata. You don't have to remember that, but it's the ordered or natural aspect of all things. All things have a nature in that sense. And when I say I like being in nature, I really mean I just like being out of the city, you know. Or I just like it when it's just me and a few other people around, just me and a few other human beings around. And there are lots and lots of other non-human beings. That's what I mean when I say I like nature. Because all words are abstractions. All words are abstractions because what words are pointers to experience. They're just pointers to experience. Rather than the experience itself. That's the nature of words. But some words are more abstract than others. And nature, in this sense, I like nature, is a highly abstract and vague idea or concept. It's a very flexible concept, put it like that. And so that's why I like the way we use the word as in the nature of something. Or the nature of. The nature of fire is to be hot. Yeah? People have particular natures. It's in the nature of genes to, after a year or two, have holes in the knees. Isn't it? You know, it's their nature. Grass grows. Rain falls. You know, grass is green. Rain is wet. It's their nature. Everything has its particular nature, its particular set of qualities. The way it works. The way its particular conditionings come about. So that's certainly the Buddhist way of looking at things. In other words, in terms of all the conditions that bring stuff about. Or you could say the way things emerge from their unique conditionings that surround them. And there are all kinds of natures in this sense. You can see many different realms of life with their different natures. Buddhism singles out, of the infinite number of different natures of things, the famous five niyamas, or natures, you could say. There's matter, basically. There's matter in the sense of the elements of earth, water, fire, and air. The planets, gravity, physics and chemistry. This is, you know, it's a big part of the world that we exist in. And nature operates in those particular ways, in terms of gravity, etc. There's the whole biosphere. The realm of organisms, like you and me, bodies, bacteria, organs of reproduction, digestion, growth, decay. So there's that biological nature of things. Green nature, you could say. You could call it that. There's the nature that governs mental functioning, like sensing, you know, perceiving things, responding to things, reacting to things. All beings sense one another in various ways. They detect the stuff that's around them. There's an automatic coordination of hand and eye, or idea and voice. And there's the subtle natures of connection, that whole area that conditions how our senses function and the way we create a world out of that sense functioning. So it's another whole realm of nature. But then getting more subtle, Buddhism singles out in particular the nature of action, the nature of deliberate action. All conscious acts, everything we do consciously, has a particular effect on the person who acts. And this is a very particular realm of nature, which in a way Buddhism specializes in, you could say. It's the area of karma, or ethics. Karma meaning action. Or you could say the area of directing the mind. And of personal change. Ethical sensitivity has its own world of conditionality. You know, the way you're sorry when you've hurt someone. So you do your best not to do that. You do your best to be kind on a good day. You know, and that on a good day thing, it just shows how subtle the conditionality we have around ethical sensitivity. We have it. We have it. You know, the way you're, you know, that all that can go wrong. You know, you can kind of slip from that ethical sensitivity and become very hardened to others' suffering. You can become totally hardened and insensitive to others' suffering. You can become more and more of a monster. And this, again, is a potential we all have. Some more than others, in different ways. And this is this area of conditionality of the area of action or ethics or karma. It's also that whole area that covers what you do in your head. The acts you do without anyone knowing about them. And also the acts you make very sure people do know about. And all that willing is having an effect on us. It's like, behind the scenes it's having this effect. It's like Dorian Gray, you know. This guy in one of Oscar Wilde's short stories, he had a secret portrait of himself. And this secret portrait reflected how he really was. So like, in normal life he just looked like a nice handsome young guy. But up in his attic, the portrait increasingly became more and more horrible. His secret portrait. And more and more monstrous this image became. And the more kindly he was in his real life, the more beautiful this image became. And that's a bit like us in a way. So there's all these different natures, you could say, different aspects of our nature which we're very much in touch with. Everything has its particular nature and works only in accordance with its nature. Raindrops don't rise up in the sky, they just keep falling on our heads. Wounds fester or heal up. It just works that way. Food is digested, it works that way. If you open your eyes, you know, you're going to see something. It works that way. That's how eyes work. You know, be generous and it's usually going to have a good effect on everyone around. That's the way that works, you could say. So, everything according to its nature. Even spiritual development, even insight and awakening has its own way of unfolding, has its own nature. And we can call that the Dharma nature or the Dharma Niyama, the conditioning effect of the real truth of things, the way things are. When you come under the influence of reality, in this sense, actual reality, things happen. Things happen in particular ways. You come under its influence through your practice. The practice of awakening to reality through shamatha, through calming the mind with helpful ethical behaviour, and meditations like the mindfulness of breathing practice, have this sort of calming, harmonizing effect. And your practice like vipassana, coming closer to the real truth of things through seeing their insubstantial nature. That's the other branch, if you like, of Buddhist practice. And doing these things touches something very, very deep. Or looking at it another way, and perhaps a more real way, something touches you very deeply. You come into its orbit, under its influence, into the world, you could say, the world of influences that is the Dharmakaya or the Dharma Niyama, this is also called, in other words, the Dharma nature, the nature of reality or truth. And as you might notice, in my talk, I'm trying to paint a bit of a picture. Give a feeling or an impression of the conditioned nature of all existence and on all these different levels. We live in a world of influences within which we ourselves are an influence. You know, that's the way things really are. That's praticca samuppada, it's called, or conditioned arising. And we're a very important part of that pattern. And that's the kind of area I'd like to kind of get into a bit in my talk. Individually, we inherit loads of influences. We inherit the influences from the deep past of our ancestors. You know, the way our bodies are. Just the way our bodies are. Our skills and also our knee-jerk responses in different areas. The nature of our biology and the nature of our perceptual processes and the way those have emerged into the present, the present which is us. We inherit the very basic natural conditionings that are the great physical elements and the way they interact. All this we inherit with our birth as human beings. Everyone does. You know, I'm only stating what you know, but just trying to give a perspective on it. You know, our birth as human beings also connects us with the influence of our cultural and spiritual ancestors. You know, all the cultural traditions of the English, for example, or the Scots, the Irish, European, African, whatever they are, whatever those influences are, their poetry, their myths, their science, their knowledge, arts, crafts, design, and even fashion. And our spiritual ancestry, our spiritual ancestors, like the Buddha, for example, they're all there, if you like, in the background too. Even if we've no idea of the great spiritual practitioners in the many traditions, at the same time that they are there, we inherit their influence. We come under their influence in some way, in ways that can be activated. So we're born into this great web of connections of this kind. And the more you reflect on this praticca samuppada, this conditioned nature, the more you understand the various natures of all its parts, the more you can make it work for you in your search for awakening. And this is also where you can make yourself receptive to the influence of the Buddhas. This is where you can tune into, in the terms of the title of my talk, the Buddha field. It's the field of influence of the awakened ones. This is what I mainly wanted to talk about. It's taken a while to get here because it's a very, very big picture that we sit in the middle of. That whole picture is actually relevant. That whole picture is relevant. As you probably know, you know, the Buddhist path emerges from the establishment of mindfulness or awareness. Mindfulness of all that I've been talking about. This one, my notes get a bit complicated. That's good, yes, that's good. That's good. Okay, we've got it. Thank goodness. That was going to be the difficult transition. So on mindfulness, yeah. Mindfulness is the basis of the Buddhist path. And it's mindfulness of the great elements. I'm still recapping again. Mindfulness of the body and its functions. Mindfulness of the mind and its activity. Mindfulness of the ethical value of all our actions, attitudes, tendencies and habits. And mindfulness of the insubstantiality, the transparency, if you like, of all things, including ourselves. And all this practice, which many of us are doing, I would say the majority of us are doing this practice, of seeing through the transparency, leading to those little deaths, of the ego fantasy, our pride and our arrogance, our defensiveness, our concealment, and all the things that are standing in the way of that unfoldment of wisdom. Everything becoming transparent and letting in the light, to put it in more mythic terms, the light of the Dharmakaya, the real nature of life and existence. And all this being lived socially, in community and society and relationship. Now that's the Buddhist path that leads out of the establishment of a ground of awareness and the taking action in the field of behaviour. I wanted to sketch it out in this way to give some sense of the vastness of the field of our experience. Not only its vastness. Vastness in a way can be a bit confusing, even though it is vast, but also its character. Maybe this is the most important thing. Its character, its quality, its nature. This is the important thing. You know, not only that it's alive, but what the quality of that life is. As well as being this incredibly dynamic field that is our experience, here and now, as we wake from sleep, as we lose consciousness and awareness and fall into the sleep state, as we are born into life, and as we fall at death into the after-death state, even in addition to all this incredibly varied experience that is our lives, I want to draw attention to it's also being a field of awakening, a Buddha field. I mentioned a little while ago that we're connected to many kinds of ancestors, and that this ancestry, this includes Buddhas, Bodhisattvas, and other great practitioners. You know, not being too exclusive, but includes Buddhist ones as well. But what does it mean to say that? You can say it simply means there's a link. Buddha gained awakening 2,500 years ago, roughly. His disciples practiced and passed on the fruits of their practice. And it's all been kept more or less alive, you know, with its ups and downs. It's been kept alive down to the present. And we, coming into the orbit of these teachings and practices, participate in their life, in the life of those practices. And that's what it means, this Buddha field. We have a connection, a living connection, with the influence of our spiritual ancestors. We're part of that lineage, or that momentum, if you like. And all that's obviously true, and it's an important part of the meaning of the word Buddha field, Buddha kshetra in Sanskrit. But there's a far more lively and direct meaning, okay, which goes beyond the rather mechanized, literal and historical, sensible viewpoint that can still be felt hovering in the background in all this talk of influences. That is, that Buddhas are not just dead people who have an influence, in the same way that dead poets or dead writers like Charles Dickens or dead activists or dead visionaries, they all have an influence. But in this notion of the spiritual ancestry of the Buddhas, the Buddhas are not the Buddha's influence is particularly special. So that their nirvana or awakening or full enlightenment, Samyak Sambodhi, is a state beyond life and death, in which Buddhas continue to act for the benefit of unawakened living beings. So their Buddha field isn't just a cultural memory
however lively and meaningful that memory remains, but is a field of live interaction, which includes the living energy of awakening. And this is in fact the meaning of Buddha Kshetra, Buddha field, and other such terms like Buddha nature, Dharmakaya, Dhamma Niyama, the nature of awakening. That in some way, I'm trying to be not too literal here, but in some way we do not yet understand, awakened beings exist from their own side. I don't wish to suggest an interpretation of how the awakened ones exist. It's beyond my understanding. I only have my own conviction, based on my interpretation of my experience, that in some way the energy of awakening is a tangible force in the universe. But even just on that scientific principle of energy that states that every action has an equal and opposite reaction, it seems to me reasonable that volitions and consciousness are not simply cut off at death, and that there can the continuity of consciousness applies just as much to enlightened as to unenlightened consciousnesses. And that doesn't mean that Manju Ghosha or Avalokiteshvara or Tara or Shakyamuni and all the Buddhas of the great 1,000, 3,000 tree chiliocosm, it doesn't mean that they actually exist out there, maybe on glorious thrones. It doesn't mean that they exist out there concrete, real and permanent any more than it means you or I exist here, concrete and real and permanent. We just don't know about either mode of existence. The reality of being, and that's also the being that we're in, that we know, this kind of being, the reality of that being is beyond our understanding. All beings are said to be non-dual, insubstantial, indescribable, actually, in their nature. So, the manner of the Buddha's existence is no more mysterious than our own. It's also a very, very interesting link. You know, we don't know what we are, either. So all we can say is that their nature is perfectly wise and compassionate. So this field of compassionate energy is something that, in the words of my title, can be tuned into. It's not like tuning in like a radio. It's not a wavelength with a kind of certain frequency and suddenly you get it and it just starts coming in. It's more like one becomes attuned to a certain atmosphere, a certain vibe, a certain vibration. And how we do this, I've already explained. It emerges from the path of mindfulness, integration, positive emotion, and those spiritual depths that come from insights. All is seen as transparent, and the golden light of Dharma can start to emerge from them. And this is the classic, you can say, this is the classic Eightfold Path, or the Threefold Way of ethics, meditation and wisdom. You can say it's that, simply that. We can also see tuning into the Buddha field in terms of sadhana, meditation, in which the initiated person visualizes his or her own body as it really is, conditioned and transparent in the way I've been saying, with the centers of subtle energy at the crown, the throat, the heart, and elsewhere as well, illuminated by subtle color, symbolic color, and mantric syllable. And this subtle body being filled by the light of the influence of one of the Buddhas or Bodhisattvas, under whose protection That person has been placed by their preceptor. We can see also tuning into a Buddha field in terms of devotional practice, ritual, and especially puja. Puja is just a non-specialized form of sadhana practice, and it can be very powerful, inspiring medium for connecting to and attuning oneself to the field of the Buddhas. You do it and it works. You can feel it working. So I hope, just concluding now, I hope this will help show in more depth the purpose of some of the less obvious results of our spiritual practice, of mindfulness, ethics, meditation, and the development of wisdom. I feel it's good to bring in the dimension that is not me or mine, that is not my project, that comes from beyond anything I can know or plan for. And that's the end.